This is the Lucy's Record Shop podcast. I'm your host, Mary Mancini. After working at Elektra Records in New York for several years, I moved to Nashville in the fall of 1991. I didn't know anyone, and I didn't have a job. About 6 months later, a friend who was visiting asked me to take him record shopping. I took him to Phonolux and The Great Escape and Tower, but they didn't have a great selection of the type of records he was looking for, which were new releases on independent labels. He said, "You should open up a record store." And I thought, wait, that's a really good idea. Fast forward a few months, and I had rented a commercial space on a desolate section of Church Street near downtown, and also right next door to The World's End and Midnight Sun, one of Nashville's few gay bars at the time. And because I couldn't afford rent on both an apartment and on the space, I moved with all my stuff and Lucy, my three-month-old Weimaraner puppy, into the storage area in the back. Lucy's opened on August 16th, 1992. It was called Revolutions Per Minute at first, a pun that fit because the original plan was to have a place where people could mix music with activism, and the stock on the walls was mostly bands on independent labels and 12-inch vinyl for club DJs. As the first month came to a close, it became clear, though, that Lucy was just as much of a draw as the vinyl, maybe more so, so RPM became Lucy's. By October, word had spread, thanks to some really helpful new friends and supportive people, like talented graphic designer Brad Talbot, who designed the logo for free twice, and Nashville scene writer Jim Ridley, who was an enthusiastic champion of anyone who tried to create something new and different. At the time, the store became somewhat of a destination for record shoppers. And while in-stores were definitely part of the plan, turning the shop into a full-time club was not. Enter Don and April Kendall, who had other ideas. Although I don't think any of us knew it when they stumbled into Lucy's in the fall of 1992. At the time, Donnie and April had a booking agency called House of Pain. And because of circumstances beyond their control, they were once again looking for a new place to book the all-ages punk shows they had been putting on for years. Then one day, just by chance, they found themselves standing outside a brand new independent record store with about 1,000 square feet of unused space. But before we get to all that, a little bit of their history. How did you guys meet?
At McGavick High School in Donelson, Tennessee, where he was bussed in. He came to my side of town. And his friend and I were working in the library. And he came in to see his friend, and that's how we met.
And was it love at first sight? Did you start dating right away?
Nah, not really.
So you were friends first?
Yeah. It was on and off for a while.
And were you playing in bands at the time, Don?
No, this was before that.
But you were playing...
When we were dating.
Yeah.
But you played guitar, or no? When did that start?
I played guitar in my bedroom. It wasn't very promising.
Okay, so you're kind of on and off.
No, we were on when she was when she was mad at her boyfriend.
So, all right, so how did you finally win out?
We saw each other at a bar. I had told her the last time, I said, when you leave this next time, you're going to owe me a steak dinner because I'm tired of this goofiness. So I saw her at a bar. I left a note on her car and said, you owe me a steak dinner. Just call me when you're ready to settle up. And then she called me and said, I'm ready to settle up.
And the rest is history?
And then
was it?
That was it.
You made your choice?
Yeah, it was a good choice.
When did you start loving music and deciding to book bands? Like, what was that process like?
The month that April moved in with me, January 87, was also the month that I joined my first band, Rednecks in Pain. All of this happened kind of simultaneous. I had been a music lover for a much longer. For me, it started when I was 10 or 11 and saw Kiss live. Probably that was the game changer for me and said, this is really awesome. This is what I'm into. But when the band started, I quickly learned that in order to be any kind of successful, we had to be able to play shows. And the quality of shows we were getting were poor. And so I immediately said, this isn't going to cut it. We've got to have better shows. And so we started seeking out places. And
describe what you mean by poor.
House shows or just not well organized shows where you just kind of show up and play. And just there was no organization to it. I mean, back then, Elliston Square, which is now the End, had 2 to 4 Sunday afternoon matinees with hardcore bands. And that was really it. And everything else that happened was just some kind of randomly organized, you know, may make it, may not make it, you know, anything could happen kind of thing. And I wanted more stability. So I was out looking to find places locally to book shows and then trading shows with bands in other towns. So the band from Indianapolis would come in and play with us, and then we would go to Indianapolis and play with them. So it just kind of all gravitated from that. We need better shows.
Of course, well, you know, we didn't have the internet and texting and all that stuff, so it was basically the phone ringing all the time.
The landline.
Yeah. The landline ringing all the
time. No cell phones either.
And had the, whatever you call it, the
answer
machine that would be full when I would get home. And
oh, really?
Write down everybody's numbers. And
beyond Elliston, I went and booked a show at the Canada. I had a booking agent from California call me. She had Neurosis, was looking to book a local show. Went to the cannery and said, I've got this band from California. I want to do a 6-band bill. And Steve West, good guy, had been around forever. And he said, all right, we'll do a show. And so we did a show there with 5 or 6 bands. And then we would go to Douglas Corner and do a show, or we would go to Sal's Rock Block and do a show. And there was, at that time, there was no consistency. It was just wherever you could do it. So whoever you could talk into doing a show, you'd do a show. If it worked, you'd do another one. And if it didn't, it was gone.
Well, and also, too, we were doing all ages, so it was kind of hard to figure out how to do that.
So why was it important for you to do all ages?
Because most of the folks that liked our type of music were younger.
Well, and there was nowhere to go, you know, for the younger kids. So it was just one of those things that we kind of wanted to do because we wanted a place to go when we were kids.
Yeah, and for our band, you know, if we did an all ages show, we could draw 50 to 75 people. If we played a drinking show, we would draw 12 people. So it was obvious that that was the crowd.
Were guarantees for the bands that you were booking a thing? No, it was.
No.
Were you getting paid at all? I guess what I was thinking is, like, if you played a show where there was drinking, you could get more money than an all-ages show.
Well, yeah, you'd get more of the door, but if 12 people show up, then, you know, it pays your beer tab.
Math.
Yeah. Yeah. And we learned it early on, and you'll be surprised by this, but Elliston Square, Tommy Smith, this big redneck guy, he did those shows on Sunday because it was an opportunity to make a little bit more money. So the deal was you had to pay the sound guy $25. He kept 50%. The band split 50%. And he was straight up about it all the time. But, I mean, he was always nice to me and allowed me to book shows and treated me fairly.
Were they called migraine matinees back then?
No.
How did that happen?
I don't know. It's just some dumb name that we came up with.
I think that
came out of when we were doing the stuff at the Pantheon is when that first came.
How did you get to the Pantheon?
Oh, man. The Pantheon, my first exposure there was probably going to see the Fixtures from L.A. played there, and Caustic Solutions, who are friends of ours, were opening. And so I went to see that show. It was my first time going to Pans. And Pans at the time started out as a sci-fi strip club with bands. So they would have bands playing.
A niche.
Yeah, if you will. It was in the corner of the park between the Hilton Hotel and the Country Music Hall of Fame.
It was down there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a garage. It was an auto garage that had been converted. And
you would have loved it.
And by the time I got there, the strippers were gone, and it was just bands, because I think that nobody was making any money, and they're like, this is stupid, we're not doing it. So, and then we booked a few shows there. A band I was in called Cousin It played a show there. And then I went to a few shows there, and then
G.G. Allin.
Yeah, the G.G. Allin thing happened in November of 91, where he was booked to play there, and Fire Marshal came about an hour before the show and shut it down.
Before anything even happened?
Yes, because they didn't want him playing there.
Oh, it was specifically they had heard about G.G. Allin.
And they received complaints, and so they came down and basically wrote a laundry list of every code violation that they
had. Well, and I think he was wanted, too, on some stuff.
And so they shut the club down, and it took them 3 or 4 months to get open again. But when they did that, another guy came in named Brian Lovgren, and he was pretty smart and drew a lot of the, you know, cool bands, L7, Jesus Lizard, Babes in Toyland, a lot of really cool bands, and he was pulling all those in, and they said, why don't you come and do a weekly Sunday show? Same concept as Elliston. It's a day we're not making any money and we need to make some money. We agreed to come in and start doing the Sunday matinees, and that's, we had to come up with a name, and that's the Migraine Matinee is what we came up with.
So great.
And that's where it all started, basically.
And that was probably spring of 91, so really less than a year before we met you.
What happened? Because it sounds like you had a nice home.
We did have a nice home.
In a weird place. I imagine downtown Nashville. What was it like then?
It was pretty gritty.
Nasty.
And did you say Bridgestone was being built? Or
Bridgestone bought all that property.
That's kind of what started.
And that's
started
what happened.
Pan, I just kind of got tired of it and put it up for sale. And in the fall of 91, Gus Palace became the new owner and called it the Abyss. And at the time, we were told that, hey, you're welcome to stay. We'd love to. We're not changing anything. You can do exactly what you've been doing. Keep doing it. And I had dealt with Gus for several years and knew that he was in it for all the wrong reasons and really just wanted to make money off of bands and didn't really care. May have cared some, but, you know, hindsight is 20/20. But we just decided we weren't going to do that. So we just started looking for a new place to do the Migraine Matinees.
Begging people.
And did you find any? I mean, were you able to book some?
Well, Douglas Corner was letting us do some stuff there.
But he couldn't do a regular weekly deal, which at that point we were trying to do that because we wanted to keep the crowd, have a consistent space.
Sure, that momentum is really helpful.
Yeah.
Donnie and April continued their search to find a home, meeting with every potential venue in town, but didn't really go very well.
All the meetings were bad. Because nobody wanted to.
He just didn't want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, we had been in the Springwater earlier that day. And
sounds like a perfect fit.
Yeah. So we're pitching the idea, it's all ages, and you can't sell beer while we're doing the all ages show. And they basically said, well, why would we do that?
So because
I'm going to give you 50% of the door. And they're like, that sounds horrible.
Right. And kids? No, thanks.
Yeah. So it was. Yeah. There weren't many people who were really excited about doing that.
I mean, it's kind of like when Pan did it and Douglas Corner did it. You know, we had to either take the bottles off the bar. You couldn't have them up there, or you had to cover them up. You know, they couldn't be seen. It was weird for them.
They had one last option left. So they traveled to a desolate section of Church Street near downtown to knock on the door of The World's End and The Midnight Sun, one of Nashville's few gay bars at the time, to see if they would let a bunch of punk kids take over on Sunday afternoons. But before they even went in for the meeting...
Oh, shit.
There's a record store. I didn't know about this. How did I not know about this?
And we just stood there and looked at it like, what?
So we decided... I think we decided just to pop in and take a look before we had our meeting and just kind of came in, said hello.
So the question is, do you remember us walking in there?
I do. And I remember Donnie walking in and saying, hey, how you doing? We're just going to take a look around. And I was like, okay.
And you and made we a really beeline. Did.
You made a beeline. Because the way the store was set up, right, it was pretty long and thin space, right? Mm-hmm. 2,400 square feet. So it was separated into three sections. There was the front section of maybe about I don't know, 1,000 square feet, maybe not even that much, because I didn't have the inventory to fill up the rest. And so then there was this giant open space in the back. And then the very back was where I was living at the time.
Right.
So my thought, or the way I remember it, is you walked in, we're just going to look around. You made a beeline into the back and you noticed all of the...
Well, I tried to look at the records first. There just wasn't that many of them.
I just remember, I remember him going around that wall, and I was still standing up front, and he came back around and was like, "Oh shit!" I mean, he.
But how do you, in your mind, how are you putting that together, right? Because there was no stage, there was no sound system. It was just an empty space.
That's all we needed.
What made you think, I'm going to pitch this idea to this person I don't know and see if she bites?
Well, we were already looking for a place to do shows. And so we were seeing, we had been in the Springwater. Springwater is a smaller space than the space you had available, with a little tiny stage at the corner. There wasn't much there. The Midnight Sun was a dance floor in a dark room that you couldn't tell how big it was because everything was black. So it may have just been really tiny, or maybe it was bigger. I don't know. Right. It didn't have a stage. So we were having to, you know, it was just, you find the space and then figure it out.
And then the next thing I remember, people were coming in with giant pieces of wood to build stuff. like I can't remember the stuff that happened in between. Was it that day that you said, we want to do this? Or did you come back?
That day we told you what we were, why we were there, which was, we're looking for a place to do shows. And you just kind of took in the information but didn't really say much. And then we discovered that you were also living there. And then the takeaway was, as we left, was this would be a great place to do shows, but damn, I mean, she's living there. So if the police come in and shut it down after the first week, you're homeless. So I was reluctant to go down that road, just because we didn't know you and we're not trying to make homeless people. It wasn't worth that.
But I think we wound up getting together and meeting and...
We came back a couple of times and talked about it some more, and we explained that to you and said, here's the dilemma. And you said, well, that's pretty legit. And then I think you actually called us back and said, hey, I've been thinking about this, and I think it's a really good idea. I think we should do it. Yeah, and then once you said that, I was like, well.
Watch us.
Yeah.
Well, okay, then the next step was a bunch of people coming in with giant pieces of wood.
Exactly.
Right? Because, yes. I mean, it was instantly, that's the other thing I remember, it was instantly you brought a community there. Because you had a bunch of people around you already that were loyal to what you were trying to do in the music community.
Right.
And so it wasn't just you guys and Troy. It was like an army of kids, right, basically.
Well, they loved every minute of it, and we did too.
Yeah, we were coming off of booking 6 months worth of every Sunday shows with 3 to 4 bands a week and, you know, 30 to 100 kids showing up. So we had built that following, and once we quit doing the shows, they were all kind of standing around going, well, what are you going to do?
we having shows at your house?
And so we were trying to communicate and get that word around that we're trying to find a space. Just hang tight. We're going to keep doing this. And it was just a matter of trying to find the space. So once we said we have the space, then it was go time.
Yeah. And you built a stage.
That was easy. We can build a stage tomorrow if you want to.
Maybe.
That part was really easy.
That was easy. And then you have the sound system that you brought in.
Yeah. That was a little harder.
Why was that harder?
Because we didn't have one.
Oh. We didn't have one.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah, so we had to go buy one.
And we were trying to figure out how we were going to pay for it. And fortunately, we knew the guy at the record or at the music store, and he let us... kind of helped us out.
And
then
we built the wall between the record store and the space.
Because before you guys came, it was just a rolling partition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had this vision of putting wheels on these giant pieces of plywood or something. Kind of worked, you know, and thinking like be able to move it easily, you know,
once
I got more records in.
Exactly.
move it back.
And but then you built an actual wall, like a real floor to ceiling, and the ceilings were really high.
Yes. Which was nice.
that build out was probably 2 weekends, maybe? Because no, you're
probably a full month.
You're both working full time at this point.
We worked full time jobs the whole time Lucy's was there.
Right.
The full time job allowed me to have the luxury of being in a band and having some money in my pocket so I could do what I really wanted to do, which was, you know, have a record store and, you know, be in a band and put out records and do stuff like that. Back then, that's what I wanted to do.
When did the record label start and the zine and House of Pain? Where does that fit in that
so
timeline?
The zine started first. It came out of the brain of Sean from Rednecks mm-hmm. and Pain. He's the one who came up. He was like, hey, I got all this crazy stuff. Let's do a zine. And Kat was there and he said, I can do some stuff. And I said, I'm willing to help.
And Troy.
And Troy came in, I think, on either 2 or 3. Mm-hmm. He didn't come in initially, but he would help Rednecks and Pain out. So he'd go help us with the shows and, you know, keep us out of trouble. So the zine came first, and then we were trying to put that on a regular basis. And then the next step was, let's put out records. You know, why not? And so I think our first record was Stupid Americans. And we ended up putting out 20 records.
And House of Pain, another just goofy idea?
I have no idea where it came from.
Really? Mm-mm. You just stumble into the best names ever. My Great Matinee, House of Pain, Rednecks and Pain. We haven't even touched on Fun Girls from El Pilot yet.
I just love the O in it. I just thought it was a good play on words, the House O Pain. I think that's the reason I went for it.
So you walk into Lucy's, you're like, hey, Mary, let's put on a show. You build everything out.
Yeah, it wasn't let's put on a show. Let's do shows here. Because I believe you had already done the They Might Be Giants kind of in-store thing. And you had...
Right. You had it in your head.
I just needed you guys to solidify it.
But it was a huge deal for us because the part you don't realize is that at the time, and as we were doing those shows, there a lot of bad stuff happened where a reverend petitioned Metro to stop having all ages clubs in the bars because they were bad for kids. And we had to go to the Metro Beer Board and fight it. And I mean, it was a big ordeal. And, you know, it wasn't unusual for the codes or the fire marshal to show up at shows and shut them down. The guys that were in FUCT had a guy, and they put together a club, spent a bunch of money, called Club Roar. And I think they may have gotten 5 shows, and they were shut down forever. They never got back. And so there was a lot of fear and, like, uncertainty that this may work, it may not.
Well, and you're in the Bible Belt, too.
The difference, they
did not like it.
Yeah, the difference was there was no alcohol, so that made it a little bit easier. But the hard part is you were living in the space. And so...
Apparently that was not an issue with me. Okay.
Yeah, I guess you were at the place where it's like, hell, I can live anywhere. If I can live here, I can live anywhere. But we were thinking of it as, you know, if this goes to shit, you don't have a place to live. And we don't know you well enough to put you in our house yet.
You and Lucy. Sweet baby Lucy girl.
Lucy. Thank you for bringing that up because I forgot all about that part of the difficulty of, like you said, April, living in the Bible Belt. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very different time back then, right?
Oh, sure.
When you went to the beer board, I mean, that's early advocacy, right? You're advocating on behalf of not just yourselves, but the entire community, those kids that relied on that show and that there was nothing else for them to do, right?
I was mainly fighting the Jesus guy.
Oh.
I wanted to do shows, and Jesus dude shows up and is being an asshole. So the main fight was that guy can't win.
And you were successful?
Yes.
I didn't do a whole lot other than show up and keep pressing. Metro's attorney, Kenneth Sawyers, was pretty good, and she shut it down. They basically held me at bay and said, you know, there's nothing to debate here. We've got to figure out should be discussing this. And they came back and she made a ruling that it's none of their business.
Because you were doing everything right.
Yeah. There was no rule to say you can't do it. I mean, you can't have kids, you know, you can't have 12-year-olds drinking beer at a bar, but that wasn't happening.
Yeah.
But they also didn't like the type of music.
Everybody was concerned that the youth was going to be baptized in Satan. And the reality was most of the youth was being ignored by their parents. So that was much worse. They were just on their own.
They wanted community. They needed support.
Just right?
They just needed a place to be
yeah.
and a group to belong.
Yeah. So they could be themselves, you know, just be able to wear their leather coats and whatever else they wanted to do and not be judged. Because everywhere they went to the mall. If they had colored hair or whatever, you know, they were judged. They were bad people by the way they looked.
You really took the don't judge a book by its cover to heart with those kids.
For sure.
Where'd that come from? Do you remember? Do you know
why? We were those kids. We were that.
Well, and that's what I was going to tell you.
Okay, yeah, no, tell me, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I worked for the Baptist Sunday School Board, so I was in it. You know, they wanted you to go to chapel every morning if you worked there, and I wouldn't go to chapel, so, you know, I was an outcast because I didn't do what they told me to do. And then, of course, I grew up in the church, and you get judged by all that if you didn't go to church, you know, Sunday night. Wednesday, you weren't in the choir or whatever. And so I just think, you know, we got to the point where we just like wanted to have a place for people to go and be themselves. Because we wanted to be ourselves.
Yeah, it was kind of a byproduct of what the real goal was, but you could quickly see that it was good for the people that it was good for. It was bad for the people it was bad for.
I mean, and there was some bad times too,
yeah.
You know, but...
Who was it bad for?
The kids that were... cutting loose and heading down the wrong road. For every success story there was at Lucy's, there was two bad stories of it was their pathway to worse stuff.
As they got older, it seemed like they got worse.
And that probably would have happened anyway, but I mean, that's just with anything. But I believe the success stories are more bigger than the...
Yes.
But again, these were kids who were on their own. They were being ignored by their parents. They were different, and they didn't have a place. So anything could have happened. And some of them embraced what was there and learned from it, and some, it was just part of the pathway. I mean, I was the same kid when I was that age. I mean, I was doing a lot of really bad stuff. It could have went poorly for us as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we went through it all, too.
And part of it is luck, too, right?
Ton of it's luck.
I mean, you make a decision. You do.
You have to.
But there's also, we all did stupid stuff when we were young that could have ended up...
incredibly bad.
Right. Yep. And so there's part of it that's, you know, you're just
some
like,
some people are more lucky than others.
Right. So, getting back to the first show, do you remember what it was?
I don't remember the date. I remember it was in early December of... 92, and it was Vomit Spots, Impetuous Doom, and I could not tell you the other two bands.
And it was a Sunday.
It was a Sunday.
It was a migraine matinee.
Yeah, and I think 30 people showed up.
And which were 30 more than I had probably in all the other Sundays combined.
But, I mean, you know, it was a start. It was momentous in that we had actually... made a stand, stopped, and had found a way to get it back and carry on.
Every Sunday, right?
Yeah.
It's Sunday. We're broken down in the top of Massachusetts looking for a hotel room. Show's off. It's pretty heavy.
There was one very interesting thing about those shows after all of this talk that we had about doing the right thing and being in the right place and making sure that all, you know, where you ever do your shows, the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. But there was something about those shows that was none of that.
No, right? we had no permits. We had no business. You may have had a business license for a record store. It would not have survived a fire marshal or code visit.
It was very under the radar.
It was very under the radar, which is why we decided we were going to do it on Sunday during the afternoon, because it was more low-key.
Yeah. And then you get a bright idea.
Bring it up to go.
Well, it didn't start that way. We were building momentum, and we started doing some stuff during the week, and then we had a chance to do a Jawbreaker show. And the Jawbreaker show was June 12th, 1993. So it was early summer of that first full year. And it was a Saturday night. And it was like, we got to do the Jawbreaker show. And so Teen Idols opened. I think we had 150 people that night. And that was really the catalyst to say, okay, this is real. And if it's going to be real, we got to do it right. I'm not going to walk around wondering who's around the next corner and when it's going to be shut down.
And that's just the Donnie Kendall way, Mr. Positive.
And then we shut down to get up to code. We went and found an architect who designed the plans for free as a favor. And then we went and permitted it and got a person that I worked with's husband did the construction. I got a loan from my mom for $8,000 to fund it. And we committed to paying her back in the next 2 years. And we got it up to codes. And we did our first show back in January of 93. And that's really when it took off. I mean, that's when it was a fully permitted, let's go space. And we started booking 15 to 20 shows a month. And initially, I was doing most of it, but you built a network as well. And your network was totally different than my mm-hmm. network. And that really created a dynamic that was pretty awesome because I was covering the more heavy stuff and then you were covering the more indie stuff. And it really just made the whole thing that much better.
When Donnie and April came to Lucy's, they brought with them a sense of fairness and integrity, values that influenced our interaction with every band. And it didn't matter if your band was just starting out or if you were popular and established, we made sure that you were taken care of.
It was important that the bands get paid because going out and doing shows out of town and getting $3 sucks. I've done it. It's part of what happens, but it's not great. So what I always appreciated, it was easier to get $3 if you knew that the person doing the show had put their effort in and had done it fairly. It's when you get $3 and you know that the club made $500 or $600, that's real tough to bear. So we tried to come up with a system that was at least thought out, explained, and straightforward. But, you know, we had to have 50% because that was the only way we were going to be able to pay the rent and the utility bills and do the things we had to do. So we had to keep some money. We couldn't just let the bands have it all. But you wanted to make sure that the bands got something, especially the out-of-town guys that are traveling. Our goal was to bring good bands to Nashville that I wanted to see. And I figured if I wanted to see them, everybody wanted to see them. So that was the main goal, and just making sure people got paid. And so if it was a bad night, maybe we wouldn't take 50%. If there was only $40 to go around, I think there was many a night where mm-hmm. we just didn't take our cut yeah. and just gave it all to the bands just because we had to. And a little bit different for us versus you, where we had a job. We weren't trying to make money off of this. It was beer money for us, really. If we made enough to cover a dinner and a couple of beers, then we were fine. But, I mean, you were trying to run a business, and it was where you were living.
Most of the bands that played Lucy's were looking for a creative outlet, right? It wasn't about getting signed. It wasn't about a record deal. And you didn't really have to have a lot of experience to play.
No, not at all.
Right?
No.
And there were some really great bands that played there and some really not so great bands that played there.
More not so great than
some bands that like just formed just to play
at
Lucy's.
Yeah, and some became great bands after they did that. Yeah. And others decided, wow, this is not for me, and quit.
That was fun. But this one sheet basically says, so you want to play Lucy's, talks about all shows are all ages always, means no alcohol. If an audience member or a band member gets caught with alcohol, you'll be asked to leave, even if your band is about to perform.
Been there, done that one.
What happened?
They just decided they were going to walk in with a bunch of beer and didn't care. And I took the beer away from them and took the beer outside. And then they somehow got it back in and they were on stage. And
you're referring to Buzz Owen. Yeah, they played. I mean, there was no stopping.
But I took their beer off the stage, which made them mad.
Is that when you got your nickname?
I guess. Maybe.
No, she got it much earlier than that.
I don't think Buzz Oven gave me that name, but no. They probably had a bunch of other names. But
you worked the door.
The bitch.
Who worked the door.
And I'm still that bitch.
In all the best possible ways.
That's right.
She was the enforcer of the rules, and it was a constant game to see if you could manage to make it past the front door without paying. I mean, it was a constant, you know, hey, are you here for the show? Oh, there's a show. Oh, you know. So without having somebody rigid at the door, you can lose a lot of money. And we're trying to get the bands paid.
I do have to ask you about something funny I read in an issue of Olive Loaf.
Okay.
They asked you what bands that you tried to book at Lucy's that said absolutely no way, that they don't want to play, or we couldn't afford. You couldn't afford, and you said that Jawbox wanted $350, Alice Donut wanted $1,000, but you offered them $800.
I was getting desperate. I wanted to land a bigger fish, and yeah. My biggest thing was NOFX, which I'm reading their book right now, and I'm doing the research. I went and I've got a letter from Fat Mike from NOFX just blasting me for blasting him.
Wait, why did you blast Fat Mike?
Because he wouldn't play Lucy's for $350. He wanted $500.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't budge.
Wouldn't budge at all.
And so you wrote him and said, come on, do it for the...
Yeah.
How punk rock is that?
Exactly. And then said, hey, if you want to send your records, we'll review them, and ad space is pretty cheap. And so he wrote me back and said, hey, screw you. I don't know who the hell you think you are, but don't tell me my ethics. You try getting in a van and touring for 3 years and not making any money and blah, blah, blah. And it's big letters, so shut up. And then after that, he says, I'd be happy to play some ads and send you some records.
And how did that letter land with you at the time?
I think I just sort of laughed and said, whatever.
Okay.
And then I actually got an opportunity to discuss it with him when they played 328. And Philip from Teen Idols pulled me from the crowd and said, come back and meet Mike. And so I went back and met him, and I was half drunk. And we talked about it just briefly and said, yeah, I sent you that letter. It's like, no harm, no foul. And he was like, I could care less. But the problem was Dwayne Dennison from the Jesus Lizard was sitting right next to him. And so I walked up and met him, and I'm just confused and like, Dwayne, what are you doing here? I was like, it's Dwayne from Jesus Lizard. And so Mike, he got second.
And Green Day almost played.
Green Day was booked to play. I had it tied down, and then they decided to stay in New Orleans an extra day so that Mike Durnt, the bass player, could see his grandmother.
You mentioned the anti-extravaganza. Do you remember how that came about? There was the Nashville Entertainment Association, which was literally part of the Nashville Area Chamber of Commerce, did a showcase every year,
right?
And it started out with 20 bands, and then each year it got more and more popular and more bands, and then all these A&R people and managers would come in from all over the country, and it was a premier event, right, for showcasing new talent in Nashville.
If you say so.
Yeah, right.
That's what they said. That's what they said.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it to do the anti-extravaganza?
So it was mine, and it was out of spite.
Of course.
Most everything I do is out of spite.
Now, that's not necessarily true.
It's not true at all, no, but it is funny.
Well, I mean, we submitted stuff for the NEA because the way it was promoted was it's unsigned bands, anybody, they're trying to find talent. And we knew some other bands that submitted as well. And they weren't looking for the best bands in Nashville. They were looking for the most groomed bands in Nashville that already had representation and were ready to make that jump. But they promoted it as something entirely different. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like, this is the best of Nashville, and it was just completely corporate and BS. And so when I had the opportunity to poke at them, and I did that several times. I mean, all these little goofy names that we come up with, and that one was pretty easy, just to say, let's do an anti-extravaganza.
On the same weekend.
Yeah. We're going to have shows anyway, mm-hmm. so we might as well take advantage of it and try to have some fun with it. And so we came up with the anti-extravaganza and just tried to pump it up and did, added an extra band to the bill and tried to make it more of a thing. And it caught their attention.
Oh, it did it? And what'd they do?
So they the second year they came to, I think they came to you. I don't know. I can't remember if they came to me or you, but they basically said, this is great. We love what you're doing. So we would like to incorporate it into the actual extravaganza.
No, thanks.
And my answer was, well, if you knew what we were doing, you you wouldn't come to that conclusion because that makes no sense at all. Because we are basically saying you're fools and we can do it better than you. Mm-hmm. And so we did the thing where it said, if you show up with a laminate, you have to pay twice as much money.
So shows were always $5 all the time.
That's right.
And it was 10 for them, and they had to take the laminate off to come in.
So, oh my God.
I don't recall anybody showing up with a laminate, but because they would never do that anyway. Because
I don't know. People, I think there was a couple that showed up.
And you, the bitch at the door, was like, give me your $10.
Of course.
Yeah. The enforcer.
Yeah.
But that's when you know you've done something right, when you know the very thing that you're poking a stick at comes to you and says, oh, we love this. Poke me harder.
They just didn't like the anti part of it. They wanted to shut that down.
No, I think they just saw it as a marketing ploy to say, here's a way we can capture more territory without having to actually spend money on it. Yeah. We'll just incorporate them into it, and it'll look cool.
Lucy's closed in January of 1998. Right before the last weekend of shows, Jim Ridley wrote in the Nashville Scene, quote, from the moment it opened in the summer of 1992, Lucy's Record Shop was destined to close. A pop culture movement is by nature ephemeral. It emerges in the moment and flickers briefly, and its demise is inevitable. In its moment, it may embody the exuberance and spirit of its time so precisely that it seems poignant in retrospect. But any movement defined by youth is destined to end, just like youth. The cyclical nature of rock and roll demanded that Lucy's wouldn't last, end quote. Jim's writing is poetry, and it rings so true, but there were also more practical and personal reasons why we closed the shop. And what's really interesting is that at the time, none of us understood the impact closing would have on the community of kids who went there. We just didn't realize what the place meant to people.
Why did we close?
It was time. So we were happy.
I'll tell you my tell you my story.
Yeah.
And then I'll tell you what I recall of my interaction with you. By that time, I was extremely burnt out, showing up at Lucy's on a regular basis and having a full-time job and playing in a band. And
we were parents.
We were parents. And I was out of runway.
This was 98, and this was 97, December probably of 97. We closed in 98. When was Samantha born?
96. So she was two.
96. Okay, so she was.
And when Samantha was born, Sandy, I quit Fun Girls, knowing that I wasn't going to have enough runway. And so I was out of room. And I got to the point where I don't know that I have any more in me. And I mentioned it to you, and I don't know if you were just placating me or if you were with me, but you basically, your reaction was rather immediate, and you mm-hmm. said, I'm okay. Yeah, that's fine. And so my takeaway in that initial conversation was, you're ready to.
And I think I had been thinking about it for a couple of months.
Were you married then? Mm-hmm. Were you and Kurt married? Okay.
No, I was not placating you. I had been thinking about it. So I think I was relieved when you actually said that this was, I think, because I may have been thinking, like, how am I going to broach the subject?
Yeah, how do I get out of this? Yeah. With this guy that's just nonstop, just go.
Well, and I don't even think I was going at the time because
no,
I was staying home with Samantha.
Yeah, you were only coming out every once in a while
when she would go to the grandparents.
Yeah, very rarely. Really, we weren't the trio that we were when everything was awesome, when it was in its prime. It had gotten cut up and we were doing what we had to do to get through it. And, you know, hindsight being 2020, we could have went another way. But at the time, I wasn't thinking about the kids and what it meant to everybody, because I was seeing what was happening on a regular basis, which half the shows were really bad. And there would be 25 or 30 people, and the bands were bad. And, you know, we'd have three good shows a month, in my opinion, and 10 bad shows. And so it was hard to see the bigger picture. All I saw was right in front of me, and I was tired of it. And I didn't really realize the legacy that we created until much longer after it was gone. But I will say, by the time we quit, I was, from a music standpoint, I was broken, where I didn't care or listen to music for at least a year or two after that.
Wow, really?
And it had been everything in my life up to that point.
Wow.
And I was so burnt out that I just separated from it.
And what brought you back out of that? Do you remember?
Just time.
Yeah.
Yeah, just time and kind of slowly dipping my toe back in it and giving it a try. And, you know, it's still awesome. Music's awesome.
Been trying to get him to play again, but...
I'm past that point.
Never I would love never. It.
It's just like running Lucy's Record Shop. People don't realize what people in bands go through. There's moments of ecstasy where you create something that's awesome, or you release, you know, you play a show and people get it and you get that. But just about everything else involved in it is crap. Dealing with people trying to book shows, it's loading your gear, it's going back and forth. I mean, it's a damn job that doesn't pay worth a shit.
Yeah. Right. And that I think that was one of the considerations that I had too at the time was I knew to make the store better, it either had to move to another place where there was more foot traffic and more, you know, and take the store to the next level. I would have also had to take out another loan, you know, small business loan. And I looked at all that and I weighed that with being newly married and fortunate enough to travel a little bit with Lamb Chop and just wanting to have it's funny, right? Wanted to have a regular job. Like I was like, oh, 9 to 5 sounds great. Right. And so I had turned 30. You just get to a point where you're just like, okay, I'm at a crossroads and I need to do something. But it is nice to know that something that we created has left such a legacy because,
for sure.
I mean, when we get together, which isn't often enough, undoubtedly over the last 30 years or 25 years or whatever since it's closed, there's always that story that, oh my God, I ran into a Lucy's kid, or I'm sitting at the bar and somebody's talking about Lucy's, or, you know, it's just, it's a good feeling.
You just never know how you're going to touch people.
Right.
And I had no idea of that piece of it at the closing of Lucy's. People were coming up going, no, you can't do this, but I didn't realize the legacy that was there until well after we were closed.
And really and truly, you know, it wasn't that big of a thing. You know, it was just a good thing.
It was a moment in time.
The other great thing that's come out of this is lifelong friends.
Yeah,
for sure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have any stories, pictures, or music you'd like to share from Lucy's, or have questions about things that we didn't cover, or about people you'd like to hear on this podcast, send them along to @Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, or email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. There will undoubtedly be a part 2 of this conversation, because there's a recent update to our partnership. For now, though, let's just say that to this day, Donnie and April Kendall continue to build community and support a thriving local music scene. For more info about the stuff we touched on in this episode and links to full versions of the music featured, visit the episode notes or go to lucysrecordshop.com. Many, many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio, and to Lamb Chop for the intro music. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Again, thanks for listening.